The Books Podcast, presented by Tim Haig.
Welcome to The Books Podcast. I'm Tim Haig, and I'm delighted to be here. We've enjoyed many splendid authors on the show, including Howard Jacobson, Joanne Harris, Ian Banks, many more. Subscribe now on your favourite podcast player to hear them, and of course, please tell your friends. We have a cheerful subject to talk about today, death. Specifically, Death and the Victorians, which by an amazing coincidence is the title of Adrian Mackinder's new book.
The Victorian Age. It's the bridge between this kind of a romantic, superstitious past and the rational, modern now. Even developed a way of killing, which has got a name, it's called burking, where they would muffle the life out of some people, then stuffed in a barrel. They would sort of roll them over to the royal surgeons, and Dr. Knox took these fresh corpses.
I ask you, gentlemen of the jury, is this the kind of book you'd like your wives and servants to read?
Adrian, thank you for joining us on Books Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me.
Well, the Victorians had a lively relationship with death, didn't they?
They did. They did. They had I would call it a reframing in terms of their relationship with death, which was at the core of what I find so fascinating. They wanted to reconnect with the dead. And I think that lies at the heart of, runs through the heart of what I've written from the book, which is, you know, they'd lost touch with the dead. They'd lost touch with the literal ability to pay their respects post the sort of, you know.
And of course, today we've largely shunted the dead out of our lives as well. The proximity of death for the Victorians was a snapshot in time. I mean, in your preface, you write that my fascination with death has been a constant in my life. So you were a morbid little thing, were you?
I was a morbid little child. I always used to go to dark places in my head. When I was, this is true, I haven't said this, I think, in anything. When I was very, very small, my father had a calculator that used to play green sleeves in a rather tinny one-note fashion. And I used to take the calculator and I'd go behind the sofa and I'd play the green sleeves to deliberately make myself feel a bit sad and think about how the fact that all the dinosaurs were dead.
you obviously had a sensitive soul.
Or obsession with the death and loss and something. But I, you know, and as you say at the beginning of the book, I dedicate it to my father because without him I wouldn't be written this book, because it was because he got me fascinated with ghosts and the supernatural. I like to thank my father and Reader's Digest, because there's a certain generation whereby these kind of books are just around the house. And he had books about the supernatural and the occult, and Into the Unknown was the book. And I would look through it and look at the pictures when I was too young to really read the text. And as I got older, I got into that. And then he also got me interested in the crimes of Jack the Ripper, the Whitechapel murders. Through watching the Michael Caine.
The world's, you write of him, he's the world's first superstar serial killer.
Very much so. I mean, there have been others before, and now we've realised more sensational, like H.H. Holmes. But I think Jack the Ripper was the first killer, sadly, and I'm glad that we've reappraised the perspective and we should be focusing and remembering on the victims, not glorifying the murderer. But I think he was the one where, thanks to the Victorian tabloid press, was given this superstar status, and it was all a glorious gothic whodunit.
We'll deal with that, because, of course, that's all part and parcel of this whole subject, death and the Victorians. Mm. And as you say, it is possible to put brackets around this time and say something was different and was particular about it. I want to start by talking about cemeteries. You love cemeteries. And of course, if we go to a Victorian cemetery, we can see a large part of the relationship that the Victorians had with death and their attitude to it. Why was the cemetery, and why do we think of the cemetery as an expression of Victorian culture in such a strong way?
Well, I think that the lavish landscape garden cemetery, as we know, is pretty much exclusively, certainly in London, a Victorian invention. And it all stems from the beginning. I was saying about how the living had lost touch with the dead, because during the Industrial Revolution, urbanization, the growth of the city meant the population grew exponentially, as of course did disease, and the death toll rise exponentially, and they didn't know what to do with all their dead.
Too because, of course, in the dying. Past, you'd be buried in the church graveyard.
In the church graveyard, yeah.
In some little village.
Absolutely.
But then when you've got millions of people agglomerated in a city.
And not just
you've
that.
You've got a lot more corpses.
You've got a lot more corpses and significantly a lot more anonymous corpses. Back to your point about people were buried in a village graveyard in a church, people would know who it was because it'd be, oh, that's Jones the butcher. Mm-hmm. He gets buried in the church graveyard. But, you know, with these huge great cities, you know, that were just being sort of spawned up, particularly like Liverpool, Manchester, and of course London, the corpses were being fished out of the river, you know, or found in alleys, or just there we find these huge tenement buildings which were full of families living together under appalling sanitary conditions. So people were dying left, right, and centre. Of course, death is with us as a constant, but this level, they need to do something. And the graveyards, the church graveyards, were just getting too full.
So before they established all the Victorian cemeteries, what happened to the corpses then?
Well, that was, and I touch on this in the book, that was what was so interesting, is they were literally coming out of the ground because they were stuffing them in as much as they could, and there was no room. And, of course, cremation was illegal in the UK until the late...
1885?
Yes, absolutely.
I learned from your book.
Absolutely. I learned when I was researching this. I didn't realise it was, you know, largely thanks to the work of an eccentric pagan from
Christianity,
Wales.
Isn't it? Christianity said that the body was going to be bodily resurrected.
So it had to be completely pure, which is why bodies that were given over for vivisection were usually the bodies of criminals because they'd forfeited the right to enter into heaven. So therefore you could do what you want with them. So, you know, criminals and murderers were allowed to be
But nonetheless, there was some pretty undignified events that happened to all these many, many corpses. You tell us about a church where undercroft is just full of...
Oh, it was horrific. It was basically the enterprising young men found a way to capitalise on death. So, you know, you had Enon Chapel and the Green Ground in London. I think Enon Chapel stood where the London School of Economics is now. So it's around about that part of the central London. And
the stench of death still there.
Oh, absolutely. It's horrific. The stench of death and learning. So they had these, this chapel had this basement where the reverend, the vicar in charge of it, he saw this opportunity to give poor people something that they lacked, which was a secure burial because of these resurrection men, these grave robbers, these body snatchers. They could offer a service that otherwise would be too prohibitive cost-wise, where he goes, we can take your body and we bury it under this chapel and it will be safe because it will be in a crypt. Now, what they didn't mention is that they were stuffing so many of these bodies under this crypt in a tiny, tiny space. It was only a few square meters. They think, you know, hundreds and hundreds of bodies.
It can't have smelled very good.
No, it couldn't have smelled very good. And there was even reports of when there were people upstairs during service, there was, you know, the flies were coming up through the cracks in the floorboard from all the cadavers downstairs that were giving off all this gas, which was another thing, of course. They believed in this concept of miasma, which is they thought that diseases could be airborne through corpses giving off gases as they putrefied. And it was only when they discovered, due to the sheer horrific nature of the smell and what have you, that there was I think it was the local militia or the local sort of, you know, I hate to use the word ombudsman, but some official in the area around Enon Chapel went down. They discovered that they'd basically been stuffing these corpses, ripping them apart. There were limbs. It was absolutely revolting down in this space. So the guy was essentially a con man. He wasn't offering the peace of mind that he was selling, you know. And so that was just one example of these horrific situations that people out of necessity were forced to part with their hard-earned money, you know, for their loved ones who had passed away. So what they did is they realized we need to set up a business so we can actually reconnect the living with the dead, because people could not go and pay their respects in these graveyards because of disease, infection. It was just being rather grim. So in London, the good example is the Magnificent Seven. The seven garden cemeteries were created.
Exactly. Now, I had no idea that it was seven cemeteries.
Yes.
Everybody thinks of Highgate Cemetery, which is gorgeous. We go there recreationally. I took my daughter there last year to look around. But that was just one of seven. Who knew?
That was one of seven dotted around the city. And it's interesting. I think Highgate is the most impressive. They all had a theme. The way they were put together, yeah, they did. They all had an architectural theme. And this was interesting about when they were constructed, because they were put out to tender by architects. The people in charge of creating these garden cemeteries were given the remit by the government to do so. But it was a private enterprise. You had to pay, you know, so, you know, being buried, you know, death was free, but being buried cost something. And they said, well, what are your proposals for this cemetery? And it's like, well, we either go for a classical look or, you know, or a Rococo look or something, and it affect the architecture. There is an Egyptian theme running through Highgate Cemetery, which has resulted in some absolutely stunning architectural designs. But as you said, and this is crucial, I think, to the point I'm making in the book, you know, you went there recreationally. That was the point. The Victorians wanted to create a space where you would want to go and pay your respects to the loved ones, but also maybe sit and have a picnic. There's the Magnificent Seven Cemeteries in London was influenced by Père Lachaise in Paris. The man responsible for putting this together basically looked around Père Lachaise and thought, this is stunning. All this deliberately avenued, lined architecture, the green space, the flora and fauna that was deliberately encouraged to be there, made it a pleasant place up on a hill overlooking Paris. Crucially, this was the point. They were outside of the city.
Yes.
So you could get away from the funk and the grime and go and sit somewhere amongst the dead and reconnect.
Funnily enough, last time I was in Paris, so we were staying in the 12e arrondissement, so it was a short walk to Père Lachaise. I said, come on, family, let's go. I went on my own. Nobody would come. But I love these places.
Well, I think they're absolutely stunning. I mean, I think Highgate also has gained an extra bit of cachet because it was often used in, say, Hammer movies in the 70s, and it keeps popping up. I watched an episode of a new comedy on Apple TV, I should point out other streaming services are available, about Dick Turpin with Noel Fielding, and there was a whole section of that filmed in Highgate Cemetery. I recognised the Egyptian Avenue immediately.
Very distinctive. And yes, that little circle with the cedar.
Yeah, the cedar of Lebanon.
Absolutely. Is in dozens of Hammer films, of course.
Exactly. And so, you know, that's a testament to its aesthetic pleasures. Plus, these cemeteries also became a place to be seen and to be buried, which is why often part and parcel of these tours of these cemeteries, you'll see notable burials and you'll get the tale of the people that were buried there.
Well, you know. Speaking of which, we're going to touch on various individuals who come up in your book. Lizzie Siddle, you tell us that story. It's quite familiar, but I'll bet you that some people are not familiar with it. Sketch it in and tell us what it tells us about the Victorian attitudes to death. Tell me about Lizzie Siddle.
Well, Elizabeth Siddle was a, I suppose you could say, the muse of Rossetti, the eccentric artist, poet, flamboyant gadabout town, who was an interesting character because, apart from the fact that he had a menagerie in his house and he was not afraid to indulge in, shall we say, whatever he could get his hands on. But his muse, when she died, Rossetti buried with the corpse of his beloved muse a small tome of his poetry. And when he fell on hard times financially, his agent, I suppose agent in the loosest possible term, someone trying to cash in off his waning credibility, said, do you have any work we need to, you know, maybe this is the way you can make some money, is, you know, and he said, well, the only work I have is buried with my beloved.
And he didn't make a copy, did he?
No, he didn't make a copy.
Big romantic gesture.
A huge romantic gesture. This is by how much the stuff that pours from my heart and my mind is in with you. And so under the cover of night, three men and two grave diggers were paid, I think they were paid in beer, to go into Highgate Cemetery under the cover of darkness and dig up this poor woman's grave to retrieve the book of poetry. But
ooh.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. Was it ooh? Because the way that the story has been presented was when they opened the casket, she was as she had appeared in life. She hadn't decomposed at all. Her cascading red hair and her hands were clutching this piece of poetry. That's the story. I doubt it was true. Even if she did look exactly as she appeared in life, in death, I imagine a few seconds later she just sort of faded into a desiccated
corpse. Like a Steven Spielberg film.
Exactly, just like the bit in Indiana Jones and the Law of Diminishing Returns. And so I think that was the reality. But the point is, they portrayed this romantic ideal of death, that it was somehow a beautiful thing, which was to be set apart, of course, from these rotting corpses literally coming out of the grave in the graveyards. Which, of course, by this point had been closed. This is another thing. In London, the graveyards had been closed. You couldn't bury any more people just because there was no more room, which is another reason which there was expediency to create these garden cemeteries. But yes, it's a fantastic tale because it has this Gothic romanticized ideal. And of course, you know, there was a Gothic revival towards the end of the Victorian age. And I think that certainly paints into the works of the time that you would say, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, Dorian Gray, And certainly this whole idea, and of course, Bram Stoker's Dracula in 1897, you can't help but think that that story would have had been a little bit of an influence on Bram Stoker in portraying this sort of beautiful, timeless, ageless state of death, which is, of course, not the reality, whereas you become a soup.
Yeah. Before we, because we've got a lot of other things to talk about, but before we leave cemeteries, I did not know about the necropolis line, which I find a really interesting and startling thought. There was a train, a dedicated train from where did it come? Euston or somewhere?
It was Waterloo.
Waterloo
down to Woking Cemetery. Is it Brookwood Cemetery?
Brookwood Cemetery.
I wrote that
in Surrey. Yes.
In Surrey, yes. And it was basically, you know, you could pay to take your the dead, and it was for the dead only, and take it directly to their place of rest. But what was particularly interesting about that is because you would travel according to class, even in death. And that says so much for the British system. So, you know, you wouldn't want your riffraff and hoi polloi corpses mixing with the first class carriage of corpses. So, you know, even in death, you had to know your place.
And it opened in 1852 and ran till 1941. Mm. That sounds really modern to us.
Well, and I think that's the key to why I wanted to focus on the Victorian attitudes, because I think that the Victorian age, first by virtue of the fact that the Queen Victoria lived, her reign was so long, you know, second only to the late Elizabeth II, It's the bridge between this kind of romantic, superstitious past and the rational modern now. We can associate so much as this tension between the two worlds colliding during the Victorian age, of people trying to use modern technology, modern infrastructures to make sense of something that is inherently superstitious. You know, there is only ever superstition attached to death because we don't know what lies beyond the veil. So I think the Victorian age was defined by these two worlds colliding, people trying to use the latest science and latest technology, latest engineering of the time to make sense of something that is timeless and ageless and essentially heathen.
You mentioned the resurrection men, by which we mean the grave robbers, these people who went round abstracting dead bodies from graves or tombs, or and making them available for nefarious purposes. And you discuss Burke and Hare, who are the most famous of them. Although they didn't actually do a lot of grave robbing, did they? They were mostly murderers.
They sort of, it was the classic tale of escalating crimes. When they realised how much money they could make, because a bit of background if people aren't aware, as we touched on earlier, it was very hard for surgeons, the emerging sort of surgeon industry, the medical industry, to acquire cadavers for operation, because of course it had to be a certain kind. And also, of course, the fresher the better. So retrieving a sort of, you know, 6-month-old corpse to be dissected on the slab is not necessarily the best way to teach human anatomy if most of it's putrefied into liquid. So Burke and Hare were two Ulster men who come over, and they were in Edinburgh, and they discovered there was a lot of money to be made in getting fresh corpses. And a lot of the surgeons would take the corpses, give the money, no questions asked. But what Burke and Hare did was they realised, well, hang on, what's even fresher than a fresh corpse? How about someone that isn't a corpse yet?
Yes.
So they even developed a way of killing, which has got a name. It's called Burking, where they would get absolutely drunk. They'd find various people, because they stayed in a lodging house, and they would, shall we say, muffle the life out of some people in an inebriated state, and then in the back of a barrow or in a stuffed in a barrel, they would sort of roll them over to the royal surgeons, and Dr. Knox in particular took these fresh corpses.
And there was a gang in London doing this who were called Burkers.
The London Burkers, which shows the nature of celebrity and yeah. You know, because when they eventually were caught and found guilty of the trial, they it's Burke was caught and hanged, and Hare did a run.
Got away. Well, he turned state's evidence, didn't
he? Yes, he did, and then legged it. So he was still out there, but
and disappeared.
Disappeared into the night, and I always like that smiling. He really, because he. A lot of people think he was the one that basically manipulated, you know, Burke into getting involved with this nefarious enterprise. But the point is, yeah, there was the London Burkers, which were bait, and they in that part of London, again near the hospitals, near where the surgeons would operate, in every sense, they would often have a room at the back of a pub where they would sell their fresh meat, shall we say. Again, there were murders involved where they believed that people, you know, would have disappeared, which again could happen with greater ease because of these big cities with these anonymous corpses, these anonymous lives, these souls, particularly those unfortunate, those who were destitute, those who had no money, those who were drunk, you know, they could easily just vanish.
We're going to come back to spiritualism, or
yes,
because you touched on this. I was going to ask you, why did it surge in that sudden way? But you have touched on it. It's this collision between superstition and modernism, isn't it? That sense that the Victorians had that mysteries could be discovered and that devices and technology would help you do it.
Absolutely, so, yes. I mean, the thing is, it's a very simplistic way to... some has been said, okay, so when Darwin came along with The Origin of Species, he blew a hole in conventional religion, and that hole left a vacuum where people were now a little bit more suspicious or cynical about their Sunday school lessons about what lies beyond the grave. But it's interesting, someone said, so why didn't the Victorians become generations of atheists if Darwin comes along and pokes a hole in it? First of all...
G.K. Chesterton raises his ugly head, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
When men stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in almost anything. The interesting thing about spiritualism is that we might tend to dismiss it as a kind of superstition, but there was a very sophisticated side to it as well. You've got, I've got a list that you gave us: Edison, Mahler, W.B. Yeats, Conan Doyle, and Lewis Carroll. All of these people believed in ghosts, fairies, in some cases.
Well, yeah.
I always wonder, you know, with people like Conan Doyle, who'd lost a child, and Horace Greeley, the American newspaper man and politician, I think he wasn't he?
And Stead as well,
Horace Greeley lost a 5-year-old son.
Yep.
How far was their commitment to spiritualism an act of desperation? And how far was it really much more a wider, social attitude?
Well, I think there was no doubt in some particular cases it was a reaction to loss. I think no matter what religious tradition and upbringing you have, when you lose a loved one, also no matter how commonplace death was in the home during this time due to illness and, an infant mortality being much higher than it is now, thankfully, there is definitely a case where this is part of the grieving process, is to actually believe, well, they're not gone. They just passed into the other room. And if we can communicate with them, then we get the ultimate reassurance and peace of mind. This is spiritualism presented as a balm, in a way. I think there is a wider context whereby, and this is where the spiritualist movement rose up in the United States. And that's not insignificant, because there were a lot of evangelical Christian movements that, and I don't think that's a coincidence that the spiritualism became popular. Again, showing that the spiritualism can sit side by side within a religious orthodox framework, but it was an extension of that whereby, of course, we can understand and still listen to the angels and the spirits. And you've got to look at the work of Emanuel Swedenborg who wrote about the concept of angels. And, you know, there's a lot of theological overlap between the supernatural. And again, look, this religion is supernatural by definition. If people can adhere to a particular tribe and join the Society for Psychical Research, which, of course, was the official body, which was fronted, and this is not insignificant, it was headed by, you know, great thinkers of the time and scientists and literary figures and authors and artists. And these were not gullible, you know, ignoramuses who just believe what they were told. A lot of what they did for a living was based on critical insight. And they were convinced that this is the answer to a question that's been around for millennia. What happens after we die?
Some quite nutty people got quite a serious hearing. You tell us about Golden Dawn, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
The Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Like,
and the Theosophical Society, Madame Blavatsky.
Madame Blavatsky.
Well, I first came across in a T.S. Eliot poem.
Well, the influence of Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society shouldn't be undermined, you know, or it shouldn't be underestimated, I should say, because in terms of the contribution of embracing Orientalism, which was a big aspect of Victorian culture, was a love for all things from the Far East. Blavatsky was this Russian mysterious enigma who basically, people kind of a little bit more cynical say she fabricated her entire past.
Get her away.
Exactly. Because she could, because you could in those days, because she wasn't on TikTok.
There were people who were self-invented in a very real way in this time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this was a very good means to do so. So she presented herself to the West as this spiritual figure who was raised in some vague, this is the thing, being sort of Ukrainian, Eastern origin, Russian origin, it's kind of ambiguous. You sort of sit, you don't sit far east, but you don't sit west either. And she was given a platform to create, co-create the Theosophical society or whatever you want to call it, really, which was basically, if I was being cynical, it was a repackaging of Eastern esoteric thought and presented in a nice Western way.
Mm-hmm.
And as I point out in the book, that hasn't changed from anyone that, you know, has sort of taken the very tenets of Kundalini yoga or Theravada Buddhism and conjured it up in a nice Saturday morning yoga class in a hot room.
Oh, I have a quote principle from your book. If you dig deep enough, you'll find theosophical influence in the environmental, animals' rights and vegetarian movements. That's what you're saying, is that these things, these ripple through culture.
Absolutely. And I think another aspect why there's such, it's such a vivid and rich period and fertile period of study is because it isn't that far away, historical terms. So, yes, we're not that far away from the Victorian age. So we can still see that whether it will fade out and lose currency, you know, down the line, is remains to be seen.
Unlikely. All those hippies in the 1960s who drifted off to the, you know, to India and looking for Eastern.
Well, absolutely. Comics. I mean, look at the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. That's Crowley. Crowley's on the cover of Sergeant Pepper. You know, a song by Ozzy Osbourne sings a song about him. You know, he's still, these esoteric Victorian cults are still very much with us.
I want to touch, before we finish, I want to touch on the literature of the time as well. This is a time when, well, popular press rises, but also literacy is exploding. And we're going to talk about the Penny Dreadfuls a little bit, because that's really interesting. And you tell us some very interesting things about what they were, how they worked, and also their extent.
Absolutely. I think, you know, basically the Victorian age gave birth to the middle class. And I think the implications of that are huge, because the popular press decided to modify their output to suit this huge, emergent, relatively affluent class, which is why, and I was thinking about this today, which is why the popular press tends to forge the middle path, which is why more radical publications, either on the right or the left, tend to fall into more fringe publications and pamphlets and fringe groups. The press catered to the middle view, which is why sensationalizing grisly murder, true crime, particularly the Whitechapel killings of 1888, was just absolute catnip.
Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, Jack the Ripper. Yeah, yeah. It was absolute catnip to this new burgeoning audience, because it was a reassuring, it was showing, particularly the conspiracy theories, that it was some members of the ruling class who were basically silencing these poor, impoverished, cast-out London. And to the middle class, behind their newspapers in their nice, comfortable drawing rooms, are lapping this up, thinking, well, thank God it's not either of us. And also that wonderful middle-class trait of, oh, look at this, you know, having disdain for those above you and below you. So these narratives of grisly murder that were found in the newspaper at the time, and certainly also the penny bloods, which, of course, that's what they originally called. The Penny Dreadful was a later name, you know, stamped on them by the quality press.
Yes, it was a derogatory term.
Very much so. They were dreadful. But the irony is, the hypocrisy is so apparent, because they would pour scorn on these cheap penny bloods, penny dreadfuls, and later blame them for all the ills of society, much like they did with comic books in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, yes, Frederick Werther in the United States, The Seduction of the Innocent.
Absolutely, it's the same difference.
And the video nasties in the 70s, which
absolutely
was inducing.
Just, this is a continuation people. Of, because there were some reports in the press of when a young boy was found guilty of murdering someone else, they found a stack of penny bloods in his bedroom. Therefore, it must be. It's like listening to the heavy metal albums, because of all the lyrics. So, you know, if you play it backwards, it'll tell you to kill yourself. You know?
Yeah, you say that true crime podcasts today are a legacy of the Victorian preoccupation with death.
Particularly the Whitechapel murders, I think, because they had to sell papers in between killings. So you have the Victorian equivalent of Rolling News, because at the end of the day, they had nothing to go on. The forensics were not up to scratch. They didn't know. This is what I talk about. You can only say for certain that these women were killed. These poor women. You can't even say one person, despite what the ripperologists will tell you. You can only say for certain that these women were killed.
And it was a very brief, it was like half a year, wasn't it?
It was the autumn of 1888.
And the whole thing happened within just a few months.
Well, this is the thing. That's the narrative that's been presented, you see, because people were killed all the time. Whitechapel was like a third world. It was incredibly impoverished. It was very dangerous. The police didn't like to go there after hours because there was so much crime, petty crime, but also risk to life and limb. So murders were happening all the time. And what's happened is the press and now the subsequent sort of historians and the ripperologists, which is this strange obsessive subset within history, they've created this narrative where there were the canonical five women that were killed. And so we start in August and we end in November and then the murders stopped. What's probably more likely is they didn't stop. They just carried on.
Croydon.
Exactly. By which time the press had moved on to other things, because the press were using it as a means to have a go at the authorities. Yeah, that was the interesting thing. The newspaper men of the time were using the Whitechapel murders to highlight how the police had lost control, how the head of the police was unfit for purpose. And some of them, such as Stead, were pursuing vendetta because of their previous run-ins with the authorities. So these poor women were just pawns in a much wider game, which was to sell papers and present a moral panic that everything had gone to seed. Something was rotten in the state of London.
Well, I think you've demonstrated definitively that death is endlessly fascinating, and I enjoyed finding out more and more about it with every page. So thank you very much. So the book is Death and the Victorians by Adrian Mackinder. It's published by Pen and Sword at £25. Adrian, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me. I could talk about this subject for many, many years until I am dead.
Let's hope not.
Yes, let's hope not.
If you enjoyed this interview, subscribe now on your favourite podcast player to be notified of upcoming episodes. Go on, click subscribe. Go on. Our next interview will be with the great Scarlett Thomas, best known for her weird and wonderful novel, The End of Mr. Y. We'll be talking about her new one, The Sleepwalkers. Please join us then.
That was The Books Podcast, presented by Tim Haig. Email Tim on tim@bookspodcast.com, Twitter @BooksPodcast, and Facebook @BooksPodcastTim.